from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Georgia Congressman John Lewis grew up dirt poor and dreaming big in Pike County, Alabama. As a young black man in the South, he was at the heart of the civil rights struggle, beaten within an inch of his life, a leader devoted to nonviolence and racial equality. He was at the podium where Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech in 1963's March on Washington. He's the last surviving speaker from that day. He's with us this hour on Point, John Lewis, on the march, the movement, his own amazing story, and on race then and now. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Were you at the March on Washington, August 28th, 1963? What did it mean? Where are we now on race? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Next week marks the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, as it was called. A march that is remembered for many reasons. This speech may be first among them.
I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification. Yes. One day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today.
There was another, less patient speaker at the podium that day, then 23-year-old John Lewis.
How long can we be patient? We want our freedom and we want it now.
We want it now. Joining me now from Washington, son of Troy, Alabama, now 13-term Georgia Congressman John Lewis. He is speaking out widely as the march's 50th anniversary approaches, and he's out with a remarkable graphic novel-style memoir that tells his story approaching that day. It's called March. We'll hear about it. Congressman Lewis, welcome. It is good to talk with you again.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. It is good to be with you again.
You were on the podium, at the podium, on the stage that day. Were you there? Could you hear when Mahalia Jackson said, tell them about the dream, Martin?
Well, I heard something coming from her, and it sounded like she was saying dream. Some people have said that they heard her say, Martin, tell them about your dream. I knew at that moment that Martin Luther King Jr. was shifting gears. He started preaching, not just delivering a speech, but preaching a sermon.
Did you know on that day, Congressman Lewis, that you were standing in the midst of an event that would become such a landmark in American history? Did you have that feeling?
I knew on that day that it was a day that, as a nation and as a people, we have never, ever witnessed before.
What was new? Describe it for us now, because, you know, looking back, we all know this speech, and we've all seen the images of the vast crowd around the reflecting pool, and it can almost seem like, you know, cool marble, like the Lincoln Memorial itself. Take us back to what was so different, new, extraordinary about it.
Well, on that day, there was a sea of humanity. When I stood up and looked down the mall, I saw a sea of humanity. Hundreds and thousands of people. On the right side, I saw many, many young people. And then I looked to the left, I saw many young men, black and white, up in the trees, trying to get a better view of the podium and the crowd. And then I looked straight ahead, and I saw so many people with their shoes off, with their feet in the water, trying to cool off. People was coming from everywhere. They were still coming, even after the program had started.
And what made it extraordinary? There was a huge crowd. There was a great speech. Was it just the fact of so many African Americans gathering in that place? What was the message that set this apart? Because already there had been marches. It wasn't the first gathering by any means. What set this apart?
This march was different. It came out of a period of frustration and a growing sense of discontent. hundreds and thousands of people have been arrested and jailed in the South. Dr. King, his colleague, the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, Reverend Fred Shuttleworth in Birmingham, have been arrested. Megan Evers, the NAACP leader in Mississippi, have been assassinated. A few weeks earlier, we had met with the President of the United States, with President Kennedy, and he didn't like the idea of a march. He said if you bring all these people to Washington, won't there be violence and frustration and discontent and disorder? And we would never get a civil rights bill through the Congress. The late A. Philip Randolph, the dean of black leadership, the chair of the March on Washington, spoke up in his baritone voice and said, Mr. President, this will be an orderly, nonviolent, and peaceful protest. We left that meeting with the president. We told members of the media that we had a meaningful and productive meeting with the president of the United States. A few days later, the six of us met in New York City at the old Roosevelt Hotel and invited four major white religious and labor leaders to join us in issuing the call for the March on Washington. And we went all across America, urging people, religious community, students, the labor community, to come, and people came.
What did you want? What were you demanding? It was the March for Jobs and Freedom. What was the specific agenda?
We wanted a strong civil rights bill. We wanted to end segregation in public education. We wanted the right of people to vote, to participate in the democratic process. In my original text, while I was working on my speech, I was reading a newspaper, and I saw a photograph of a group of women in Southern Africa carrying signs and one man, one vote. So in my March on Washington speech, I said something like, one man, one vote is the African cry. It is ours too. It must be ours. That became the rallying cry for the young people in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. President Kennedy had taken the position that if a person has a sixth grade education, he should be considered literate and should be able to register to vote. We took the position that the only qualification for being able to register to vote should be that of age and residency.
You were 23 years old, and you were chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. That was a big deal. That was a big role at that time. You know, in trying to understand the import of this day in 1963, and looking at this wonderful new book of yours, along with Andrew Aden and Nate Powell, who's drawn this up, it's just really an amazing rendition of time and place. Your personal story makes it very, very real. I mean, you came up on this little, 110 acres in Alabama, cotton and corn and peanut fields, poor as can be. Your dad bought for $300 in 1940. It was some path from that little house in the middle of those acres to standing on that stage. Begin to tell the story of how you came from that little boy with a necktie on preaching to chickens in the farmyard to being there.
Well, growing up on the farm, during the 40s and the 50s, it was my responsibility to care for the chickens. And I fell in love with raising chickens like no one else could raise chickens. I became very good at it. And as a little boy, I wanted to be a minister. So from time to time, with the help of my brothers and sisters and my cousins, we would gather all of our chickens together in the chicken yard. And they would gather outside, but around the chicken yard.
Yeah.
But they would help make up the audience, the congregation.
Yeah.
And I would start speaking and preaching. And when I look back on it, some of these chickens would bow their heads. They never quite said amen. But I'm convinced that some of those chickens that I preached to in the 40s and the 50s tended to listen to me much better than some of my colleagues listen to me today in the Congress. And as a matter of fact, some of those chickens were just a little more productive.
Yeah, maybe so. And the racial climate when you left that little farm?
When we would leave the farm and visit the little town of Troy, visit Montgomery, visit Tuskegee, I saw those signs that said white men, colored men, white women, colored women, white waiting, colored waiting. If you go downtown to the theater, all of us little black children had to go upstairs to the balcony. All of the little white children went downstairs to the first floor. And I remember coming home, asking my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents why. They would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. But in 1955, 15 years old in the 10th grade, I heard about Rosa Parks. I heard Martin Luther King Jr. on the old radio. And the action of Rosa Parks and the words and leadership of Dr. King inspired me to get involved.
And you've got the picture in your graphic novel-style memoir of Martin Luther King, the family at the radio in the little house on 110 acres in Alabama, John Lewis, 15 years old, and there came that voice. 1963, only 8 years later, the March on Washington, here's Mahalia Jackson that day, How I Got Over. John Lewis's new book is March, his experience unrivaled. He is the last surviving speaker from that day. He's with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with civil rights movement icon John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, about the great March on Washington 50 years ago next week and race in America now. He's out with a terrific new graphic novel style memoir called March that tells the story of his coming up into that day. Publishers Weekly says superbly told history, and it is. The Washington Post says riveting and beautiful, and it is. And it makes real the time that took us to 1963, August 28th, the March on Washington. Here's Martin Luther King greeting the crowd at that march.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation.
And on that point, Dr. King may well have been quite correct. And here's John Lewis. He was 23 years old, speaking at the March on Washington, same podium as Dr. King. He is the last surviving speaker from that day. Here he is.
By the forces of our demand, our determination, and our numbers, we shall splinter the segregated South into a thousand pieces and put them together in the image of God and democracy. We must say, wake up, America, wake up, for we cannot stop, and we will not and cannot be patient.
And impatient, young John Lewis, 1963, an instantly recognizable voice right there. He's with us today. John Lewis, so many people tumbling in to speak with you. Let me go straight to Walter in Newton, Massachusetts. Walter, you're on the air with Congressman Lewis.
Oh, hi, Tom. I was at the march. I took the bus down from Carter Playground here in Roxbury.
Yeah.
I was part of that great crowd, I was very impressed with John Lewis because I had been very active in the NAACP Youth and College Division 10 years earlier, and to see this young guy up there reminded me of all the young people I had worked with during the 50s. It was a turning point in my life, that march. I had been away in Africa working with the Peace Corps, and was back on vacation, and was going to return to Africa, and to hear John and the rest of the speakers was overwhelming for me.
Walter, on that day, if you can remember, how close or far did you feel from what used to be called Freedom Land?
Well, we were still a long way. As I said, I had been working with the NAACP. I had been a member. I had been the first college student elected to the national board of the NAACP in 1952, and so I knew how far away we still were. And the hope was that with this great demonstration and this great peaceful demonstration, that we would finally be able to push the administration really move on a civil rights bill, which in fact we did.
It's so good to hear from you, Walter. Walter, who was there that day, and I appreciate your call so much. And if I may, let me get one more right here from Lexington, Kentucky. Don, you're on with Congressman John Lewis.
Yes, I am a late-blooming white man who was just so naive in junior high, but when high school they integrated in Lexington, Kentucky, our school, and I began to realize in college that racism existed. And so I was a late bloomer, but at the point that I got involved was because of Marcus Raskin, who I understand was one of the organizers of the march.
Yes.
And, of course, Martin Luther King, whose book, Why We Can't Wait, and Marcus Raskin's book, The Vietnam Reader, stimulated me to resist the draft. And I went to prison for 2 years along about the same time that Muhammad Ali and another Kentuckian, Joe Malloy, resisted. And that he was the inspiration for my doing what I did.
So your eyes, your mind waking up, your eyes opening up just at that time, Don, I appreciate your call from Kentucky as well. Congressman Lewis, take us off that farm a little bit. You know, you describe a real eye-opening for you. This is years before the March on Washington, when an uncle, a brother of your mother, came, put you in the car, and with some care and trepidation drove you north to see that there was another way to live, north to Buffalo. Give us a sense of that trip, what it meant to you as a very young man, boy.
Well, I remember so well. I was only 11 years old in 1951 when we made that trip to Buffalo. But I remember two or three nights before, my mother stayed up baking pies and cakes, cooking chicken, and wrapping them in cellophane paper, putting in brown paper bag, putting food in shoeboxes, so we can have something to eat along the way.
Because stopping was no small thing. It could be very dangerous.
It was very dangerous to try to get something to eat in some restaurant. We couldn't stay in a motel in Alabama, in Tennessee, in Kentucky. We can only stop when we arrived in Ohio. And then we made it to Buffalo. And in Buffalo, New York, I saw a different world. I saw black people and white people living in the same neighborhood together. I saw an escalator for the first time. I saw an elevator for the first time. And I didn't see those signs that said white waiting or colored waiting. I didn't see those water fountain, the shining big fountain for white people to drink and a little spigot for people of color to drink. And all of that had an impact on me as I returned to the South.
I mean, you came to hear Martin Luther King on the radio. You came to listen to his message. You moved up out of Troy into Nashville. Nashville played a very formative role in your experience as a civil rights leader. Remind us what took you to the, was it Nashville, the American Baptist Theological Seminary there, and those Nashville years for you?
Well, I arrived in Nashville at the age of 17 in September 1957. And there I started studying the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. I came under the influence of a young man by the name of James Lawson, who taught us the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence. He had studied Gandhi. He had studied Thoreau and civil disobedience. He knew all about what Dr. King was doing in Montgomery. But if I can go back just a moment, Tom.
Yes, yes.
When I finished high school in 1957, I wanted to attend Troy State College, now known as Troy University. Submitted my application, my high school transcript. I never heard a word from the school. So I wrote a letter to Dr. King. I didn't tell my mother, my father, any of my brothers or sisters, any of my teachers. I told Dr. King I needed his help. Dr. King wrote me back and sent me a round-trip Greyhound bus ticket and invited me to come to Montgomery to meet with him.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, I'd been accepted at this school in Nashville, and I was there for about 3 weeks. And I told one of my teachers that I'd been in contact with Dr. King. this teacher and Dr. King were friends. So Dr. King got back in touch and suggested when I was home for spring break to come and see him. And in March of 1958, my father drove me to a Greyhound bus station. I boarded the bus. I traveled the 50 miles from Troy to Montgomery. And a young lawyer by the name of Fred Gray, who was the lawyer for Rosa Parks and Dr. King and the Montgomery Movement, met me and drove me to the Fresh Baptist Church, pastored by the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, and ushered me in to the office. And I saw Martin Luther King Jr. and Reverend Abernathy. I was so scared, I didn't know what to say or what to do. And Dr. King said, "Are you the boy from Troy? Are you John Lewis?" And I said, "Dr. King, I am John Robert Lewis." I gave my whole name.
Yeah.
And he started calling me the boy from Troy. And I continued to study in Nashville. And it worked out. Because it was there that I got involved in the sit-ins. I went on the Freedom Ride. And I participated in marches. And the first time I got arrested, February 27, 1960. And I grew up. I felt free. I felt like I had crossed over. I became a different person.
I mean, this is for doing what a lot of people who know this movement only broadly know from other locations, Montgomery and maybe Selma, but just sitting at the lunch counter at the Walgreens in Nashville, and you went back again and again with this nonviolence training. One of the things from your graphic novel memoir, March, that was really moving to me was the training you all put each other through in order to be ready for the kind of abuse that you would almost certainly face when you participated in those sit-ins. And I wish you would share it with us, how you trained for that, how you prepared, and don't varnish it up too much, Congressman Lewis, because it's very moving to hear how you toughened yourself for what was sure to come.
Well, as a group of students who study every Tuesday night for almost an entire school year at 6:30 p.m., we met at a little church near Fisk University campus.
Mm-hmm.
And we had role playing. We had what we call social drama, where someone would play the role of the opposition, maybe an interracial group of black and white students. And we would pretend that we would be spitting on you, or putting a lighted cigarette out in your hair or down your back, pouring hot water, hot coffee, and trying to see could you stand the abuse, and pulling people off the lunch counter, placing you under arrest. It was preparing us to be prepared to take the beating, to take the opposition. But in so doing, Tom, we prepared what we call the do's and don'ts of the sit-in movement. And saying simple things like, don't talk back. Don't laugh out as you're sitting there. Sit up and sit up straight and look straight ahead. But sometimes we would just sit there for hours, all day, reading a book, working on a paper, or just meditating.
It was no joke. People would die. They did. There would be a head cracking. You were no small part of it on the bridge in Selma with Bull Connor and all the rest. Larry's calling John Lewis from Nashville. Larry, you're on the air with Congressman John Lewis.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to call. I'm calling from Tennessee State University, where I teach constitutional law. And really the reason I'm here is John Lewis and Diane Nash and Reverend Lawson and Reverend Vivian. I was a naive white kid growing up in Nashville when the congressman was at American Baptist and helping those others lead the sit-ins and marches. And I remember my mom telling me, "Larry, don't go downtown. There are problems down there." I had no idea what she was talking about. So, of course, I stuck my thumb out and was downtown an hour later to find out. And I saw it. I saw Congressman Lewis and the others sitting in, and a violent white mob surrounding them there on Fifth Avenue where the Walgreens and Woolworths and other eating places were. And being naive, I saw the police arrive after these white thugs were screaming, hitting, beating, spitting, etc. And I thought, oh, good, police are going to arrest these law violators. And then to my shock, instead of arresting, the perpetrators, they arrested the marchers and the folks sitting in, like Congressman Lewis. I couldn't understand. You know, I went home and said to my mom, what's going on here? I saw these people, you know, committing crimes. I'm sure I didn't use that language. And the police sort of helped them. And so I really didn't understand. It took me, you know, I had to get educated. I had to learn. And I'm really curious, Congressman Lewis, you know, why did the sit-ins happen then in the late 50s as opposed to 10 years earlier or 10 years later? I mean, I know Reverend Lawson and you and the others organized it, but, you know, why didn't an older group of kids organize it? Or, you know, with all that, with all you and your family aspired to for yourself and everyone else, I know there was tremendous pressure to keep your head down and get the college education and, quote, be a success, unquote, and not risk going to jail, not risk trouble. Why did it happen then in the late 50s and early 60s?
Larry, I'm so glad for your witness of that day and your question. Congressman Lewis.
Well, thank you very much, Larry. Where as students, as young people in Nashville, we can go downtown to a department store and buy clothing. We can go into a Walgreens or some other drugstore and buy a paper or something else, but we couldn't take a seat at a lunch counter. You couldn't get a soda at a fountain and take a seat. So we felt as students that was an affront to our dignity. And at the same time, many of us were deeply inspired by Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks. And you had the teaching of Jim Lawson. And you know, in 1957 and 58, there was a comic book called Martin Luther King Jr. and the Montgomery Story that told the story. And a lot of us started reading that book. And we started studying about what Gandhi did in attempted to do in South Africa, what he accomplished in India. Mm-hmm. We had studied Thoreau and civil disobedience. And we had test sit-ins in Nashville in the fall and winter of 1959. And then when the students started sitting in Greensboro, North Carolina, on a regular basis, we started sitting in also. And many of the students there, the first four, had read the same comic book that we had read. And that's one reason we worked on this comic book called March, because we want to inspire another generation of young people to stand up. See, I was told over and over again, like so many other students, don't get in trouble. Don't go to jail. But we got in good trouble, necessary trouble.
These days, John Lewis says, it's time for all of us to get in trouble again. We'll talk about that. We'll hear a voice from the following generation. John Lewis was there at the March on Washington, incredible personal history. It's all, first part of it told in the new graphic novel memoir, March is Terrific. Here's Mahalia Jackson from that day, August 20th, 1963. John Lewis, the last surviving speaker of that day, and he's with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Congressman John Lewis. We'll be right back.
We've got everybody in his hands. He's got everybody in his hands. He's got everybody here right in his hands. He's got the
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with civil rights movement icon John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, about the great March on Washington 50 years ago next week and race in America now. Here he was at the podium, 1963, August 28th, 23 years old. He's now the last surviving speaker from that day. Here's young John Lewis.
The time will come when we will not confine our march into Washington. We will march through the South, through the streets of Jackson, through the streets of Danville, through the streets of Cambridge, through the streets of Birmingham. But we will march with the spirit of love and with the spirit of dignity that we have shown here today.
Do you hear it? How on fire that young man was, and how principled at the same time. Lots of comments online, Congressman. Dwayne writes to us. This Dwayne says, listening to American hero, Congressman John Lewis on Point, I hope both of my sons grow up to be half the man he is. John Lewis is out with a new graphic novel memoir. It's really terrific. He's done it with Andrew Iden and Nate Powell about his early years in Alabama, sort of road to 1963 and the March on Washington. Listen, it's not all roses since then. Here he is this summer talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in June to strike down what some called the heart of a project he put so much work into, the Voting Rights Act. Here's John Lewis, 2013.
The day of the Supreme Court decision broke my heart. It made me want to cry. I felt like saying, come and walk in the shoes of people who tried to register, tried to vote, but did not live to see the passage of the Voting Rights Act.
John Lewis, speak about race relations in this country today, in the time of the Supreme Court decision, and more broadly than that, where have we come? Where are we?
We have come a distance. We have made progress, but we're not there yet. But 50 years later, since the march, those signs are gone. Our children growing up today will not see those signs. The only places they will see those signs will be in a book, in a museum, or on a video.
You mean white only, black only, those signs?
The white only, mm-hmm. colored only, mm-hmm. they are gone. 50 years ago, hundreds and thousands and millions of people could not register to vote simply because of the color of their skin. In 1963, the state of Mississippi had a black voting age population of more than 450,000 and only about 16,000 were registered
wow.
to vote. Today in Mississippi, there are more than 300,000 registered black voters, and the state of Mississippi has the highest number of black elected officials than any state. 50 years ago, in places all across the South, black people and white people couldn't ride in the same taxi cab, couldn't stay in the same hotel, couldn't eat at the same lunch counter or in the same restaurant. That is all over with. In a place like Selma, Alabama, where we were beaten, where I gave a little blood on that bridge
mm-hmm.
for the right to vote, people stood in unmovable lines. But today in Selma, Alabama, you have a biracial government with an African-American mayor. There were one county between Selma and Montgomery 50 years ago was 80% African-American, didn't have a single registered African-American voter. Today, the great majority of African-American there are registered to vote. 50 years ago, we didn't dream of having an African-American as president of the United States. So we have come a distance. So when someone said to me, nothing has changed in 50 years, I feel like saying, come and walk in my shoes.
Let me go to Lee in New Orleans, Louisiana. Lee, you're on with Congressman John Lewis.
Good day, Congressman Lewis.
Good day.
In Louisiana here just recently, there's a shipyard that's employing out-of-country workers and just doing all kinds of things to these poor people, not paying them, letting them live in squalor. And it's not just about the inequality between black and white or green or purple. It's what business, in my opinion, and just a humble person's opinion, it's what big business is doing to manipulate the population in general. You know, the question has been in my mind the past couple of days, what has the young black man achieved? The freedom to kill himself over drugs and big shiny wheels on cars? You know, there's... I'm sorry, it kind of brings me to tears in a way, because the social abuse that's going on in this country, it's terrible, you know? And I almost think it's a conspiracy. You know, the big business and the multimillionaires you know, charging 3,000% profit on a shirt. You know, it's just ridiculous, and it's way more than race. You know, it's way more than race, and it's way less. You know, the price that we put on somebody's life today.
Lee, we hear your passion. I want to take it right to John Lewis. I mean, this cuts through. Yes, there's been progress, but there are still issues, and you hear Lee lay them out right there. What do you say, Congressman?
Well, in spite of all of the changes, in spite of all of the progress that we have made, we still have many, many problems. But there's a great need in America today to humanize our institution, humanize our government, the national government, state, and local. Humanize other institutions, business, colleges, and universities. We must come to that point where we respect the dignity and the worth of every human being. That's what the Civil Rights Movement was all about. It was not just a movement for African American. It was a movement for human beings. It was not just civil rights, but it was human rights.
What about the undocumented in that context? Lee asks about them. Another listener, Yar, writes to us, addressing you directly, sir. He says, John Lewis, you personally know the brutality of hostile and corrupt people. I have a difficult question for you, Yar writes. How can you subject undocumented immigrants to 10 years of indentured servitude to the same hostile and corrupt system? Who wants to live with fear? They're one traffic stop away from deportation. He says, I know you're aware of the many ways a people can be oppressed. Will you advocate for an end to oppression for all? What about the immigration question?
I advocate ending oppression for all human beings. I think it's a shame. I think it is a disgrace to have millions of people in our own country living in the shadow. We need comprehensive immigration reform now. I protested. I attended rallies. I go on the immigrant freedom ride. I was the only member of Congress to ride a bus from Washington all the way to New York City.
You know, there's no small number of African Americans who fear that that kind of move may undercut their wages, their access to jobs.
We need to create jobs for everybody. African American shouldn't be afraid. We all are in the same boat. As A. Philip Randolph said on one occasion, maybe our foremothers and our forefathers all came to this great land in different ships, and maybe in other means, but we're all in the same boat now. So it doesn't matter whether you're black or white, Latino, Asian American, or Native American. In the final analysis, we are one people, one family, one house. We all live in the American house, and not just the American house, but the world house. And we must never forget it.
Richard in Haverhill, Massachusetts. You're on the air with John Lewis.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Mr. Lewis, it's an honor to speak to you. I'm just absolutely outraged at the Roberts Court and what they did with Title V of the Voting Rights Act. Too many people have died and been beaten. I'm thinking of Schwerner, Goodwin, and Cheney. I'm thinking of Megar Evers. We had a Reverend James Reeb from here who went down there and got beaten and killed. Riala Luizzo from Detroit, she went down there and got beaten and killed. These states, the ink wasn't even dry on the bill when these states, so many states, are starting to have these repression laws to stop the voting. Now, I understand that you have a bill in the Congress, Mr. Lewis. Could you please explain what it is to get the, you know, voting rights back?
Thank you, Richard. John Lewis.
Well, first of all, I must agree with you. As I said in that statement earlier, it made me so sad, made me want to cry. I met Reverend James Reeb when he came to Selma. I knew and met the three young men that died in Mississippi in 1964. Andy Goodman, Mickey Schwerner, and James Cheney. I knew Megar Evers. I met Viola Luzzo. These are people who gave their lives. And I do think, and I believe, that is a deliberate, systematic effort to make it hard and difficult for citizens to participate in the democratic process. And that's why I have been working with my Republican colleagues and Democratic colleagues in the Congress to fix what the Supreme Court said need to be fixed. And that's what we must do right away. It's going to take a little time for us to come together as a Congress and pass a piece of legislation to make it easier and simple for people just to register or just to vote.
Watch this space, because that will not be easy. Congressman John Lewis, you were 23 years old, 50 years ago, and the day of the March on Washington. A remarkable young man, remarkable now. Let me bring in a young African-American woman who's 23 years old today as we speak. Her name is Ailey Pope. She's a grad student in theology, like yourself earlier, at Southern Methodist University in her case. She joins us from Dallas, Texas. Ailey Pope, thank you very much for joining us. You're on the air with John Lewis.
Thank you for the opportunity to even be in this conversation and in this discussion representing young people across America.
When you look back at those images, the video, the photographs, when you hear the sound from August 28th, 1963, does it feel like ancient history to you, Ailey? Does your generation know viscerally, vividly what was fought for and won for you?
I think that for me personally, listening to it, it just sends chills through my body that, you know, that years ago in 1963, somebody thought enough to come together and make a way for me. I think that my generation knows this, and that's why we voted. I think that it's important to know that we were the young people that voted for Barack Obama. And I think that that came from our history. And I think that the concept of change and unity was something that really appealed to us, because in 1963, it was the same sentiment of change and hope.
Ailey, is your generation, our time is short, so forgive me, but I want to ask you, is your generation, not just you, but your generation, fully free and equal today? If not, where's the gap?
I think that we still have a ways to go, just like Congressman Lewis said. I think that we need jobs. I think that the discussion of just justice needs to be had. I think that there are some things that we as young people have to make a way for, but now is our time to have a dream, and we have to complete the rest of the race.
Congressman Lewis, what do you want to say to Ailey and other 20-somethings today, African-Americans, all Americans, but African-Americans in particular, about what's been won and what you hope they'll carry forward?
I think it's important for young people and those not so young to not give up, to not give in, not to become bitter and hostile and not get lost in a sea of despair, but study what happened during the 60s, listen to the tapes, watch the film footage, read the literature, and get out there and push and pull, and don't be quiet. Make some noise. Stir up the order of things. You know, during my early involvement, there were people that were afraid to be afraid. The fear is gone. Fear is gone. So now you have the technology. We didn't have a fax machine. We didn't have a cellular telephone. We hadn't heard of the internet. We had an old mimeograph machine. But we were able to bring about a nonviolent revolution in America. And you can do much better than what we did.
You say get out there and make some more trouble. What would you encourage Americans to look with moral clarity at today and make trouble about, Congressman?
Well, I don't understand how we can be at home with ourselves. How can we be at peace with ourselves as a nation and as a people when a whole segment of the population, we have the dreamers, these young people, their only country, their only flag they know is the American flag. The only country they know is the United States of America. And we make it almost impossible for these people to live with a sense of dignity and pride and happiness. They live in fear that they're going to be deported. We should have passed comprehensive immigration reform long time ago. I wish the Speaker of the House of Representatives would bring the bill to the floor, and we would pass it.
Ailey, What do you take away from that time? What do you want to take into your life? We've got half a minute here. Where do you want to put your moral energy? We've all got to make a living and all the rest, but what about your moral energy?
I want to put my moral energy into helping people around the world. In making the world a better place and contributing, you know, to the dream of Martin Luther King, but internationally and around the world, just helping. I'm continuing that hope and giving that love that so often isn't found.
Ailey Pope, 23 years old, graduate student at Southern Methodist University. Ailey, thank you very much for joining us from Dallas.
Thank you.
And Congressman John Lewis, it is an honor and a privilege to have you with us. Here we are just coming up on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Thank you very much, sir. The graphic novel memoir is March. It's terrific. Check it out. Congressman, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Here's A Dream, a song about racial tolerance by rapper Common, Will I Am, from the soundtrack of the movie Freedom Riders. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's a cold war. I'm a colder soldier. Hold the same fight that made Martin Luther the king. I ain't using it for the right thing. In between lean and the fiends, hustle and the schemes, I put together pieces of a dream. I still have one.
I got a dream.
One day.
We're gonna work it out.
One day.